Life of General Philip Schuyler. Chapter 8. Schuyler's political career after the Revolution. His part in the development of New York State. His family life while the war was still in progress, and while he was absorbed in military duties, Schuyler was called upon to take part in the political affairs of his native state, which, at this formative period, demanded the best efforts of intelligent patriots. The struggle for independence necessarily involved the building up of a new political system. The old provincial assembly, in which Schuyler and Clinton had opposed the oppressive acts of the British ministry, had been succeeded in the beginning of the war by the provincial Congress, which assumed the government of the revolted colony. On the 9th of July, 1776, immediately after the Declaration of Independence, this Congress marked the change from colony into independent state by resolving itself into a convention of representatives of New York. The first business of the convention was to appoint a committee to prepare a form of government for the new state, and of this committee John Jay was made chairman. In March, 1777, Jay presented the Constitution, which he had drawn up with his colleagues, and it was adopted in April. It provided for a government by the people, but the aristocratic idea still prevalent and embodied in Jay's declaration that the men who owned the country ought to govern it, appeared in a property qualification for the ballot which restricted the right of suffrage. The convention appointed John Jay, Chief Justice, Robert R. Livingston, Chancellor, Robert Yates and John Sloss Hobart, Judges of the Supreme Court, and Egbert Benson, Attorney General. The governorship, however, was thrown open to popular election. As there were no political parties, the candidates were suggested only by their own prominence before the public. Four men were considered chiefly by the electors: John Moran Scott, John Jay, Philip Schuyler, and George Clinton. Scott, one of the leaders of the Liberty Boys and a patriot of great usefulness during the popular resistance to the acts of the British ministry, would have made a strong candidate, but the county of New York, which contained his principal constituency, was in the power of the British army and no election was held there. Jay, satisfied with the office of Chief Justice, did not want the governorship and supported Schuyler. The Council of Safety, which then had charge of administrative affairs, also favored Schuyler. The election took place during the anxious days of the Burgoyne campaign. Schuyler was absorbed in the effort to arrest the progress of the British army, and neither considered himself a candidate, nor encouraged his friends to do so. Thus the office of governor fell to Clinton. Pierre Van Cortlandt was chosen as lieutenant governor. George Clinton, destined to play a great part in the public affairs of his native state, was of Scotch-Irish extraction, and the son of a farmer in Ulster County. In almost boyish days, he had served with Schuyler in the French and Indian War. Later, he studied law in New York in the office of William Smith. During the political struggle in the provincial assembly, which preceded the revolution, he and Schuyler had been the chief supporters of the patriot cause against the ministerial majority. In 1775 they were elected together as delegates to the Second Continental Congress. Like Schuyler, Clinton left his seat in Congress for military service, and at the time for the election for the governorship, he was brigadier general in command of the militia defending the Hudson River. He was then 37 years of age, of a burly frame, a hearty manner, active, vigorous, intelligent, a natural leader, and uniting more qualities for general popularity than any other public man in the state. Neither wealth nor family connections had assisted him. His native talents had raised him to office and were to maintain him there for 18 consecutive years. Before him, no man of a similar social position had occupied high political office. He symbolized in his career the new democracy which was arising. Clinton owed his election to his popularity among the general mass of voters, rather than to the influence of the leading men. Schuyler had worked with him since early youth, knew and liked him. For governor he would have preferred Jay, but he looked with satisfaction upon Clinton's candidacy. There were, however, a number of influential men who were not well pleased with the result of the election, who would have wished the office held by a man more in line with the conservative traditions of the state. They seemed to feel instinctively that Clinton, although now working with them, might in the future be working against them. There was a feeling of antagonism nonetheless real that it was vague and as yet without definite cause. Among the accusations made against Schuyler by George Bancroft was that while Washington wrote of Clinton's election, "His character will make him peculiarly useful as the head of your state," Schuyler wrote, "his family and connections do not entitle him to so distinguished a predominance." Bancroft inferentially represented Schuyler as having no standard for public office other than aristocratic position. The phrase which he quoted, isolated from its context and without intimation as to whom or under circumstances it was written, gave a totally incorrect and unfair idea of Schuyler's views. Schuyler knew of the opposition to Clinton among many of his friends. He was anxious to secure harmonious support for the new government. He wrote confidentially to Jay, "I hope General Clinton's having the chair of government will not cause any divisions among the Friends of America. Although his family and connections do not entitle him to so distinguished a predominance, he is virtuous and loves his country, has abilities, and is brave, and I hope will experience from every patriot, what I am resolved he shall from me, support, countenance and comfort." And to Clinton himself, Schuyler wrote soon after, "I sincerely congratulate you on the honor your countrymen have conferred on you and assure you that I shall embrace every opportunity to make you sit as easy in the chair of government, as times will admit. Your virtue, the love of my country, and that friendship that I have always and with great truth professed, are all so many inducements to it." While Schuyler was visiting Washington's camp at Morristown, in 1779, in the company with his daughter Elizabeth, the latter became engaged to Alexander Hamilton and they were married the following year. Schuyler's interest in political affairs, naturally deep, was intensified by his intimacy with Hamilton. The relationship formed the beginning of a friendship of unusual strength on both sides, in which personal affection was increased by entire agreement and sympathy on public questions of absorbing interest. During the next 20 years, the foundations of the nation were laid and its future determined. Into the burning questions then arising for settlement, Schuyler entered with all the more heartiness that his son-in-law was the prime mover on the right side. It was a time of intense political feeling. Men were drawn close together or separated widely, according to their views on public policy. During this period, Schuyler living generally in Albany, and Hamilton in New York, their views were often exchanged by letter. After Schuyler's death, this correspondence, with other interesting political papers, was found in a great trunk in Albany. Its value historically was great. It could have thrown light on the early history of the Federalist Party, and perhaps would have cleared up some incidents which now remain obscure. The intimate, unguarded views of Hamilton were there. But the son of one of Schuyler's executors, looking over the papers and finding the expressions too personal, took upon himself the responsibility of burning the whole. From 1780 to 1790, Schuyler was almost continuously a member of the State Senate and a member of the Council of Appointment, which shared the appointing power with the governor. He was also a commissioner on the Massachusetts and Pennsylvania boundaries, chairman of the Indian Commissioners and Surveyor General of the state. One of the most important measures which he carried through the legislature was the repeal of the restrictive laws against the Loyalists, which he had always opposed as cruel and impolitic. Through those disorderly and dangerous years preceding the adoption of the National Constitution, when the slight bond which joined the states was often strained to near the breaking point, Schuyler was constant in urging a closer union and a stronger central government. He procured the passage through the New York legislature of resolutions to that end which Hamilton had drawn up, and he kept the subject foremost in all political talk. In 1787, when the Constitution of the United States, lately formulated by the convention at Philadelphia, was before the people for ratification, the two great parties, Federalist and Anti-Federalist, began to take form. On the one side were the advocates of a strong centralized government which could make an American nation. On the other those who preferred a loose confederation of independent states. It was the vital question in our history, not settled finally until the Civil War. In New York, party feeling ran high. Hamilton, Jay, and Schuyler were foremost in working for the adoption of the Constitution. Clinton and his friends were against it and had a strong majority with them. In January 1788, when the Great Question was paramount in every mind, the governor made no mention of it in his message to the legislature. In June, a convention to consider ratification met at Poughkeepsie, Governor Clinton presiding. His friends, led by Robert Yates, John Lansing, Jr., Samuel Jones, and Melanchthon Smith, largely outnumbered their opponents. But the Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, Richard Morris, John Sloss Hobart, Robert R. Livingston, and James Duane, had not only on their side the strength of great and enlightened ideas, but also the advantage of superior abilities. A long struggle ensued, in which the brilliant arguments of Hamilton disconcerted the opposing majority. But it was not until it became known that enough states had ratified to show that New York would be left alone in her independence, that Clinton's party gave up the fight, and the Constitution became law in New York. As Schuyler remarked, perseverance, patience, and abilities prevailed against numbers and prejudice. In the legislature of 1788, Clinton's party had a majority in the assembly, but Hamilton, Schuyler, and the Federalists controlled the state senate. The Clintonians claimed that the choice of United States senators and presidential electors should be by joint ballot of both houses, while the Federalists contended that the choice should be by the concurrent vote of the separate houses. On this question, no agreement was reached until the following year, so that New York had no part in electing Washington for his first term nor in confirming his early appointments. In April 1789, the first great test of parties in New York occurred in the election for governor. Clinton was a candidate to succeed himself. On the Federalist side, Jay declined to run, as he was too much taken up with national affairs. Schuyler also refused, as he wished to enter the United States Senate. The only other man who seemed to have any chance of defeating Clinton was Judge Yates. He had been an anti-Federalist, but in a speech to the grand jury had declared that the Constitution having been ratified, it was every man's duty to support it. This seemed to be good enough Federalism for the emergency, and Yates was nominated. Clinton's popularity, however, prevailed, and he was again elected governor, although the legislature became Federalist in both branches. Since the formation of the national government, Hamilton had been rising in political importance until now he was second only to Washington. As the head of the Treasury Department, there devolved upon him the solution of the most vital problems which the administration had to solve. His activity in all political affairs was untiring and his influence paramount. When the newly elected New York legislature was called in extra session for the election of United States senators, Hamilton's power was exerted in a direction which caused much jealousy. One of the senatorships was universally conceded to Schuyler. But there were several pretenders to the other, whose claims on account of previous patriotic service were well founded. Among these was Robert R. Livingston. He and Philip Livingston had been candidates for governor at the first election in 1777, but they had polled a very small vote. Now the Livingstons and their friends thought that the chancellor should have the other seat in the United States Senate. Hamilton, however, had fixed upon Rufus King, a man of the highest character and abilities, but a New Englander who had only recently established himself in New York. The influence of Hamilton prevailed and King was elected. But the Livingstons felt a not unnatural resentment, and soon afterwards went over to the Anti-Federalists or Democratic Party. Schuyler and King had to draw lots to determine which should have the short term of 2 years or the long one of 6 years. Schuyler drew the short term. From 1790 to 1792 he had the satisfaction of supporting in the United States Senate Hamilton's great financial measures which so immeasurably increased the stability and credit of the government. In 1792 he was again a candidate for senator. But the wily Aaron Burr, uniting in his own support the Clintonian party and the Livingstons, and anxious to strike a blow at Hamilton, secured the seat for himself. Schuyler returned to the state senate, where he led the defense of the Jay Treaty. In 1797, at the expiration of Burr's term, he had his revenge, for the New York legislature returned him to the United States Senate almost unanimously. His health, nearly always poor, began to give way after this election, and soon after taking his seat, he retired finally from public life. Schuyler was a Federalist from the first moment that circumstances suggested the dominant idea of that party. During the critical period, he saw in the principle of federalism the only salvation of the jarring and disunited states. While Clinton and his political friends refused to look beyond the boundary of New York with anything but narrow jealousy and prejudice, while they sent two obstructionists to tie Hamilton's hands in the Constitutional Convention, Schuyler's voice was always heard urging national unity. His feelings were warmly aroused, and his efforts unremitting to procure the adoption of the Constitution in his own hostile state. During the 15 years of national life which he was permitted to see, he was never without thought for the great cause of the welding of the states into one people and one nation, respecting itself and respected by others. The noble aim, the vision of future greatness, were to be achieved, if at all, by the Federalist Party. And Schuyler was a partisan. His political associates had his time and his means always at command. And he can be forgiven if he saw in the enemies of his party his personal enemies and the enemies of his country. The reverence which he felt for the great leader of the Revolution, for the chief of the Federalists, for him who stood first, was a part of Schuyler's life. That base libelers, aided and abetted by leaders of the opposing party, should cast mud at him and seek to degrade in the public eye what was best in American manhood, made Schuyler's blood boil, made it easy for him to believe any evil of such miscreants, and made him on such issues a very warm partisan. In addition to his political interests, Schuyler took an active part in the development of his native state. From his youth up, he had made a study of the physical geography of New York. None was a better judge of the quality of land. None more surely could foresee its value by observation of the forest growth and the watercourses. His own purchases were for improvement, seldom for speculation. His possession of land meant the erection of sawmills, the clearing of the forest, and the beginning of cultivation. The most favorable terms were offered to tenants. The old parchment leases mention so many bushels of grain, so many fowls, or day's labor as rent. The individual payments were trifling, but in the aggregate they brought a considerable income to the large landowner. After the Revolution, with the changed social and political conditions, Schuyler foresaw the difficulties in the path of a great landlord, caused by the uncertainties of title and tenure. He made definite arrangements with his tenants regarding their future purchase of their holdings, and thus spared his descendants the troubles and losses of the anti-rent agitation. His judgment regarding land was sought by intending purchasers, and his knowledge was put to public use in marking the boundaries between Massachusetts on the east and Pennsylvania on the south. As Surveyor General, he had more or less to do with all the public works of the progressive times that followed the war, including the dividing up of Tryon County, the settlement of the towns of Ontario, Genesee, and Oneida, the construction of new roads from the Mohawk River to the lakes, and from Genesee to what are now Buffalo and Lewiston. With the opening of the interior of the state to settlers, he saw Albany lose its old frontier position as headquarters of the fur trade to assume that of center of a grain-producing country. He saw a line of stages established down the Hudson River, and the institution of a regular mail carrier every 2 weeks between Albany and the Genesee Valley. In this transformation of savage hunting grounds into a cultivated country, the question of transportation soon became of great importance. The old waterways and carries had been supplemented by rough roads cut through the forest between the larger settlements. But a better means of transporting emigrants and freight became imperatively necessary. Schuyler saw in canals the solution of this problem. The waterways of his native land suggested the idea, and when a young man visiting England in 1761, he had already studied the subject. In 1776, when Charles Carroll and Benjamin Franklin were visiting the Northern Department, Schuyler showed them his plans for connecting the Hudson River and Lake Champlain by a canal, thus making an uninterrupted water carriage between New York and Quebec. In 1792, With Elkanah Watson, he took up the project of a canal between the Hudson River and Lake Ontario by way of the Mohawk, Oneida Lake, and the Onondaga River. Watson examined this route in company with Jeremiah Van Rensselaer, Philip Van Cortlandt and Stephen N. Baird. Schuyler was then a state senator, and he procured an act of the legislature chartering two companies to carry out this design, of both of which he was made president. With Goldsbrough Bannier and Elkanah Watson, in the summer of 1792, he made a thorough examination of the route from Schenectady to Lake Seneca and Ontario, a country which a short time before had been in exclusive possession of the Indians. In 1793, work was begun, and in 1796, boats of 16 tons burden passed from Schenectady to Lake Ontario. In 1794, Schuyler was interested in the Northern or Champlain Canal, constructed by the French engineer, Brunel. During the remainder of his life he continued his efforts in this direction, and in the summer of 1802, when 69 years old, he examined personally the entire Western Canal route, devising improvements for locks and solving the engineering and mathematical problems himself. Such work was done by him in his age in a land where in his youth he had gone by an Indian trail and only by savage permission. With the Indians, the Great Iroquois Confederacy, Schuyler continued the close relations which had been hereditary in his family. In his youth he had often traveled the Western Trail by the Longhouse. He had fought against the savages and with them in the French and Indian War. He had known them in their power, hemming in the whites, keeping them close to the Hudson, an endless menace on the West in conjunction with the French or English in Canada. He held the office of Indian Commissioner for many years, attending all the important council fires, and was regarded by the savages as the hereditary representative of the whites. The chiefs who came to Albany always appeared at the Schuyler House, where, although troublesome visitors, they were hospitably received. During the Revolutionary War, Schuyler was the principal instrument in limiting their hostility. During the ravages of Sir John Johnson, of Brant, and the Corn Planter, on the western frontier, he was the chief organizer of resistance. Whenever business arose between the United States and the Six Nations, Schuyler's experience was used. General Knox, the Secretary of War, relied upon him. Governor Clinton wrote him in 1784, "You were so obliging as to promise to draft a letter proper to be addressed to the Indians for inviting them to the proposed treaty. I am utterly unacquainted with the etiquette to be used on such occasions. May I therefore venture to request that with the draft of the letter you will please to inform me whether it will be necessary to send copies to the different tribes and, if so, give me the proper addresses, and whatever other information you may conceive necessary." And Schuyler lived to see the decline of the Six Nations as a power to be dreaded. The treaty at Fort Stanwix pushed the boundary of New York far westward. The canals, which opened a road for men and goods to the Great Lakes, meant the end of savage possession. The great chiefs, with whom Schuyler had struggled and negotiated, saw the inevitable conclusion. The Corn Planter, who had ravaged Wyoming and Cherry Valley at the head of his Senecas, paid the penalty when he reluctantly signed away the old hunting grounds of his nation at Fort Stanwix, and felt the full force of the irresistible change when he received a tax bill from the state of Pennsylvania. Red Jacket, the great orator of the Senecas, shed tears when he found his hunting expeditions interrupted again and again by fences. Brant, the brother-in-law of Sir William Johnson, whose long and bloody career had made his name a terror along the border, realized the ruin of his race when, on his deathbed, he charged his nephew, "Have pity on the poor Indians. If you can get any influence with the great, endeavor to do them all the good you can." Such was the end of the dominating Confederacy, yielding before the irresistible advance of civilization. Schuyler had always a feeling of sympathetic interest in the Indians, and he often intervened to protect their interests. Among the mass of addresses and petitions regarding them which remained among his papers are not a few letters thanking him for services rendered and signed by the mark of once well-known chiefs. With the substitution of the state for the old province of New York, with the succession of George Clinton to the crown governorships of Sir Henry Moore, Lord Dunmore, and William Tryon, Schuyler saw some marked social changes. The manners of the Hudson and the political influence of prominent families disappeared. Landed estates were divided up among many heirs. Ambitious young men went to the cities to practice law or to engage in commerce, where town lots soon became a more profitable form of investment than the wild lands which their fathers had sought to acquire. Very quickly and naturally the English idea of a landed aristocracy was forgotten. Old prejudices fell away. Among all ranks arose the free and eager competition for wealth and success which is characteristic of our time and country. Schuyler's domestic life was happy, and the family letters which have been preserved display strong affections. He lost several children in infancy, but lived to see 8 grow to manhood and womanhood and become well established in life. The estate at Saratoga, where he had built a small house to replace the large one burned by the soldiers of General Burgoyne, was given by him to his son John Bradstreet on his marriage to the daughter of the patroon. On the occasion of this gift, in 1784, he wrote to his son, "My dear child, I resign to your care and to your sole emolument a place on which I have for a long series of years bestowed much care and attention, and I confess I should part from it with many a severe pang did I not resign it to my child. I feel none now because of that paternal consideration. It is natural, however, for a parent to be solicitous for the will of a child who is now to be guided by, and in a great measure to rely on his own judgment and prudence. Happiness ought to be the end and aim of the exertions of every rational creature, and spiritual happiness should take the lead. In fact, temporal happiness without the former does not really exist except in name. The first can only be obtained by an improvement of those faculties of the mind which the beneficent Author of creation has made all men susceptible of, by a conscious discharge of those sacred duties enjoined on us by God, or those whom he has authorized to promulgate his holy will. Let the rule of your conduct then be the precept contained in Holy Writ, to which I hope and entreat you will have frequent recourse. If you do, virtue, honor, good faith, and a punctual discharge of the social duties will be the certain result, and an internal satisfaction that no temporal calamities can ever deprive you of. Be indulgent, my child, to your inferiors, affable and courteous to your equals, respectful, not cringing, to your superiors, whether they are so by superior mental abilities or those necessary distinctions which society has established. With regard to your temporal concerns, it is indispensably necessary that you should afford them a close and continual attention. That you should not commit that to others which you can execute yourself. That you should not refer the necessary business of the hour or the day to the next. Delays are not only dangerous, they are fatal. Do not consider anything too insignificant to preserve, for if you do so, the habit will steal on you and you will consider many things of little importance and the account will close against you. Whereas a proper economy will not only make you easy, but enable you to bestow benefits on objects who may want your assistance, and of them you will find not a few. Example is infinitely more lasting than precept. Let, therefore, your servants never discover a disposition to negligence or waste, for if they do, they will surely follow you in it, and your affairs will not slide, but gallop into ruin. I must once more recommend to you as a matter of indispensable importance to love, to honor, and faithfully and without guile to serve the eternal, incomprehensible, beneficent and gracious being by whose will you exist, and so ensure happiness, in this life and in that to come. And now, my dear child, I commit you and my daughter and all your concerns to his gracious and good guidance, and sincerely entreat him to enable you to be a comfort to your parents and a protector to your brothers and sisters, an honor to your family and a good citizen. Accept my blessing, and be assured that I am your affectionate father." Schuyler's wife, the sweet Kitty very respectfully of his youth, was spared to him for 48 years. She was a woman of strong character and intelligence, able and glad to second her husband's public labors. When Burgoyne's army was advancing southward, she went to Saratoga and with her own hands applied the torch to the fields of growing grain in order that they should not afford sustenance to the enemy. She died in 1803, and Schuyler wrote of his bereavement to Hamilton, "Every letter of yours affords a means of consolation, and I am aware that nothing tends so much to the alleviation of distress as the personal intercourse of a sincere friend, and the endearing attentions of children. I shall, therefore, delay no longer than is indispensably necessary, my visit to you. My trial has been severe. I shall attempt to sustain it with fortitude. I have, I hope, succeeded in a degree, but after giving and receiving, for nearly half a century, a series of mutual evidences of an affection and of a friendship which increased as we advanced in life, the shock was great and sensibly felt, to be thus suddenly deprived of a beloved wife, the mother of my children, and the soothing companion of my declining days. But as I kiss the rod with humility, the being that inflicts the stroke will enable me to sustain the smart, and progressively restore peace to a wounded heart, and will make you, my Eliza, and my other children, the instruments of consolation. Schuyler's affection for Hamilton could not have been greater had the latter been his own son. The news of the fatal result of the duel July 12, 1804, reached him in Albany when he himself was very ill. In this calamity he wrote to his daughter, "My dear, dearly beloved, and affectionate child. This morning Mr. Church's letter has announced to me the severe affliction which it has pleased the Supreme Being to inflict on you, on me, and on all dear to us. If aught, under heaven, could aggravate the affliction I experience, it is that, incapable of moving or being moved, I cannot fly to you to pour the balm of comfort into your afflicted bosom, to water it with my tears, and to receive yours on mine. In this distressing situation, under the pressure of this most severe calamity, let us seek consolation from that source where it can only be truly found, in humble resignation to the will of heaven. Oh, my beloved child, let us unanimously entreat the Supreme Being to give you fortitude to support the affliction, to preserve you to me, to your dear children and relations. Should it please God so far to restore my strength as to enable me to go to you, I shall embrace the first moment to do it. But, should it be otherwise, I entreat you, my beloved child, to come to me as soon as you possibly can, with my dear grandchildren. Your sisters will accompany you. May Almighty God bless and protect you, and pour the balm of consolation into your distressed soul. I remain, and will always be, your affectionate and distressed parent." And 4 days later he wrote his eldest daughter, Mrs. Church, who was with M.R.S. Hamilton, "The dreadful calamity, my dearly beloved child, which we have all sustained, affected me so deeply as to threaten serious results. But when I received the account of his Christian resignation, my afflicted soul was much tranquilized. Oh, may heaven indulgently extend fortitude to my afflicted, my distressed, my beloved Eliza. I trust that the Supreme Being will prolong my life, that I may discharge the duties of a father to my dear child and her dear children. My wounds bear a favorable aspect, and the paroxysms of the gout have not been severe for the last 2 days. Yesterday I was able to sit up all the day. God grant that my recovery may be accelerated to enable me to go to New York and embrace my distressed children. Should, however, my restoration be retarded, I wish to see you all here. The change of scene may, perhaps, tend to soothe my beloved Eliza and her beautiful children. She knows how tenderly I loved my dear Hamilton. How tenderly I love her and my dear children, and that I feel all the duties that are devolved on me. The evening of my days will be passed in the pleasing occupation of administering comfort and relief to a child, and grandchildren, so highly entitled to my best exertions. The strong affections which appear in these family letters were extended by Schuyler to his friends. His correspondence with Washington, John Jay, James Duane, William Smith, Jr., and others with whom he was closely associated give evidence on both sides of feelings deeper than ordinary friendship and regard. Dangers and difficulties courageously faced bring men close together. In 1784 Washington wrote him from Mount Vernon, "In recollecting the vicissitudes of fortune we have experienced and the difficulties we have surmounted, I shall always call to mind the great assistance I have frequently received from you, both in your public and private character. May the blessings of peace amply reward your exertions. May you and your family long continue to enjoy every species of happiness this world can afford. With sentiments of sincere esteem, attachment, and affection. Schuyler survived the death of his wife and of Hamilton, but only for a short time. He died on November 18, 1804, in his 71st year. His career, honorable to himself, useful to the community in which his lot was cast, and to the nation which he helped to found, owed its success to sterling qualities of head and heart. Without genius, without extraordinary talent in any particular, he had that combination of ability and character, which makes a trusted leader. He displayed a genuine love of country lay at the base of all his public actions. The fair land which his ancestors had traveled so far and worked so hard to possess, he rejoiced in possessing and in improving. The noble river, which attracted the affection of his earliest youth and was nearly concerned in all the interests of his later life, the forests and lakes and waterways of the interior, beautiful to him as they stood in their wildness and inviting to a development of infinite value, his neighbors the Indians for whom he felt a hereditary interest and responsibility, all these were real and deep sources of attachment to the country of his birth. But beyond the advantages of beautiful and fertile lands, he valued the higher blessings of an enlightened liberty, of political rights, of a just and stable government. For the security of these blessings, he unhesitatingly placed his life and property in jeopardy, and bore with magnanimity a cruel injustice. He labored long and unselfishly not only to preserve them from foreign attack, but to establish them on the enduring foundation of the Constitution of the United States.